On this edition for Sunday, June 7th, demands for justice and change as protesters continue to march in cities and towns around the world. Those stories and more next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
Consumer Cellular offers no-contract wireless plans that are designed to help you do more of the things you enjoy. Whether you're a talker, texter, browser, photographer, or a bit of everything, our U.S.-based customer service team is here to find a plan that fits you. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. Mostly peaceful protests continued nationwide today, almost 2 weeks after George Floyd died as a Minneapolis police officer kneeled on his neck. Tens of thousands marched and rallied in the nation's capital and other cities throughout the weekend, demanding police reform and racial justice. On a street leading to the White House, a newly painted Black Lives Matter street mural is now visible in satellite photos. In Philadelphia, huge crowds peacefully filled the streets yesterday. Today, a curfew in that city was lifted. And after several nights of mostly peaceful protests, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio lifted that city's curfew today, one day early. But there was some violence. In Seattle, police used flashbang devices and pepper spray to disperse protesters. And in Portland last night, police said demonstrators threw objects and pushed on a fence outside a justice center. In Minneapolis, protesters heckled Mayor Jacob Frey and chanted for him to, quote, go home when he would not pledge to defund the police department. Protesters say they plan to continue to gather and march to keep the focus on racial justice and law enforcement reform. Today, Attorney General William Barr said he does not support changing immunity laws that protect police officers and does not believe there is systemic racism in law enforcement.
I think there's racism in the United States still, but I don't think that the law enforcement system is systemically racist. I understand the distrust, however, of the African-American community given the history in this country. I think we have to recognize that for most of our history, our institutions were explicitly racist. Since the 1960s, I think we've been in a phase of reforming our institutions and making sure that they're in sync with our laws and aren't fighting a rearguard action to impose inequities.
This afternoon, officials said 3,000 out-of-state National Guard troops sent to Washington, D.C. during recent protests are now returning home. And the Secretary of the Army said there are no longer active duty military units on standby to enter the city. President Trump remained at the White House but had no public appearances today. After a service in North Carolina yesterday, George Floyd's body is now in Houston, where his funeral is planned for Tuesday. Today, former Vice President and presumed Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden said he will travel to Houston to meet with Floyd's family tomorrow. Large crowds gathered again today in many parts of the world to protest the death of George Floyd and support the Black Lives Matter movement. In London today, thousands marched and gathered outside the U.S. Embassy to demand justice for Floyd. The protesters chanted "No justice, no peace" and held signs calling out racism in England. A similar, largely peaceful protest took place yesterday, but in the evening, violence erupted and about a dozen police officers were injured. In Rome today, protesters kneeled in silence with raised fists in solidarity with the demonstrations against racism. The gathering included thousands who wore masks while socially distancing. And in Asia, despite the official cancellation of a Black Lives Matter rally in Hong Kong due to coronavirus crowd restrictions, about a dozen protesters demonstrated outside the U.S. Embassy. While the focus of the world has shifted to protests against racism and police brutality, the global coronavirus pandemic has not gone away. Nearly 7 million people around the world have been infected with COVID-19, and more than 400,000 people have died from the disease. That includes about 110,000 people in the United States, according to Johns Hopkins researchers. New York City, which was the epicenter of the outbreak in the United States, will enter phase one of its reopening tomorrow. For the first time in nearly 3 months, non-essential construction will resume, and many non-essential retail stores will be able to reopen with curbside pickup. In other parts of the world, coronavirus infections are still rising. In India, health officials reported nearly 10,000 new cases today, a new daily record. This comes just one day before the country will reopen religious venues, hotels, and large stores after a 10-week shutdown. In Brazil, health officials stopped publishing the number of COVID-19-related deaths, a change that alarmed many public health officials there concerned about the scope of the outbreak. The death toll was last reported as 34,000 on Friday, the second highest total in the world behind the United States. Officials are now only publishing data for the previous 24 hours. The U.S. Gulf Coast states are preparing for Tropical Storm Cristobal, which remains on track to make landfall late tonight. Tropical force winds have reached the mouth of the Mississippi River, and the storm spawned a tornado in Orlando, Florida last night. The Hurricane Center says the storm is expected to bring heavy rains from East Texas to Florida over the next few days. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has declared a state of emergency, and President Donald Trump signed an emergency declaration this morning. Follow our continuing coverage of the nationwide protests and the latest national and international news by visiting pbs.org/newshour. The demand to reform police departments, from partially defunding them to setting new standards for hiring and disciplining officers, is causing local governments to consider new regulations and laws. In San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors is considering a resolution introduced last week that would urge the Civil Service Commission there to prohibit hiring officers with a history of serious misconduct. I spoke with San Francisco Supervisor Shaman Walton on Friday about the proposal. Shaman Walton, what provoked this new measure?
Well, we're just tired of seeing unarmed black men, unarmed people of color killed by law enforcement and there be no consequence. And so, one, obviously there are some things that we have to do to address that issue, but also there are things we can do to be preventative. And so urging the Civil Service Commission to never hire anyone that has had excessive force complaints, that have had racial profiling complaints or complaints of misconduct in another city.
Now, what about one of the clauses that you had was even if they left in the middle of an investigation? Is that something that you're seeing?
Well, it's something that we perceive to be happening. And if someone is in the middle of an investigation and they leave, that should be a red flag in itself. And so we want to make sure, again, that we do everything we can to have common sense policies that says we're not going to hire anyone as a part of our law enforcement bodies that are coming to harm our residents.
Do you think there are officers on the force now that might have had problems from previous jurisdictions who the city or county has hired?
We definitely know anecdotally and in fact, in some investigations, we've also found that there are officers in our police department that have worked in other jurisdictions and have had complaints.
Is this a solution in search of a problem? I mean, have there been problems in the San Francisco or the police department already, which lead you to believe that you need to take this step?
We know that there are officers who definitely have had misconduct cases and cases of excessive force that are currently on our police force. So, no, I do not think it's a solution in search of a problem. I think it is a very important step to protect our residents. And as a black man who's raising black children and living in a black community, it is very important that I do everything that I can in this role to make sure that we protect our residents.
How's this been met by the rank and file police department or their representatives?
The officers that I've talked to think that this is common sense. I've heard that there are some rumblings from the Police Officers Association. I have 9 colleagues total that support this resolution and co-sponsored this resolution. Obviously, the district attorney is on board, and this is common sense policy that I think a lot of people will support. And I definitely know that in community and even have conversations with some of the rank and file, this is something that they also see as common sense policy.
If I'm a police officer and I had a problem in a previous job, doesn't the city vet me in the hiring process and figure that out?
Officers are vetted, and anyone we hire as a city and county employee is vetted, but we need this protocol to be in writing. We need to explicitly state that we will not accept individuals from other law enforcement bodies across the Bay Area or from any other city that have excessive force complaints, that have complaints of racial profiling, that have complaints of misconduct. It needs to be written in policy that is adhered to forever.
Shaman Walton, Supervisor of City of San Francisco, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The COVID-19 pandemic has forced many to find new ways to work remotely. Our partners at Southern California station KCET bring us this firsthand account from a priest in Santa Clarita who put his passion for technology to work for his parishioners. The story is part of their series, SoCal Connected.
My first name is Father Albert, and my last name is Avenido, Father Albert Avenido. We are at St. Kateri Tecahuita Catholic Church in Santa Clarita, California. So from day one, we were already able to do a live stream. So it is truly a different situation because now we have to be here at least an hour before to ensure the sound is okay. This HDMI cable goes to the studio, and that is the sound. Once you're live, there's no editing there. So we always try to do our best, and again, I'm enjoying it. Everything is grace. Yeah, everything is grace. This is one of the graces of COVID-19 for me, to again have time with technology, with setting up all this.
Is to really have a one-on-one conversation with a shepherd. To the point that I went to a sheepfold.
It was March 27 when I received a request to do a funeral service, and then the bottom line was that I was told that I will be the only person at that service. So it was kind of a difficult situation, and even after I came back to the rectory, I've been thinking of that. How many more families, how many more people will have this kind of experience? And the last time that they see their loved one was in the hospital, because the next time it's already in an urn, you know, it's already cremated. That's hard. That's very hard. St. Kateri Tecahuita lost her family when she was very young because of a pandemic, like a chicken fox at the time. She herself experienced what we have been experiencing right now. One of the things that I realize over here is truly the value of family. The value of family. You know, your love for one another in your family that probably during those normal time, we always take that for granted. You know? So that's what I'm praying for, that when we go back again to the normal, I do not know what would that be, really. I hope the new normal would be work and family.
This past April, we reported on homeless students caught in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. One of those students was Jamie Waldron, a criminal justice major at the University of Massachusetts. At the time, Waldron was being provided year-round housing on the UMass Lowell campus, and she was worried about balancing her online coursework with her job at a local grocery store. Today, Waldron is officially a college graduate. NewsHour Weekend's Zachary Green caught up with Waldron before her graduation last week.
How does it feel to be a college graduate now?
It's like kind of scary because I'm not ready to be an adult yet, but it feels really good though too, knowing that I can go and get a full-time job and have like the credentials to get a full-time job in the field that I studied versus just working part-time jobs and still attending school.
How do your job prospects look now? Are you worried about pursuing a career when so many people are out of work and so many people aren't hiring right now?
The good thing about the field that I studied is that COVID-19 isn't going to like stop the hiring. Like, you can't work remotely in most criminal justice jobs. I've talked to someone about a job potentially in the Department of Youth Services. And then I also just got another email about an interview working in one of the prisons in Massachusetts. And so I'm not too worried right now. I really want to work with the like reentry services, like mental health services, where they're going to be living like halfway houses, things like that, just setting them up for success for when they are no longer in prison.
So you've been working in a local grocery store all this time. What has that experience been like for you during the COVID-19 pandemic?
I was really worried at first about getting sick and not being able to work or getting someone else that I know sick. Now that the face coverings are required, it makes me feel a lot better and more comfortable that like everyone's taking the necessary steps towards protecting themselves and protecting others. Now people are being more conscious about shopping and when they're shopping and if it's absolutely necessary, which makes me feel better.
So the last time we spoke with you, you were homeless and you were being provided housing by UMass Lowell. Once you leave the college, what's your housing situation going to be like?
Before the pandemic started, I had already signed a lease for an apartment with two of my friends, actually just down the street from where I live now. I will be living there starting like full-time, starting between June 1st or June 7th, depending when I fully move in, and I will no longer be living on campus.
How does that feel after being housing insecure for such a long time?
It feels really good knowing that like it's my, like where I live and it's my house. My legal address at first was my aunt's house where I didn't live, and then it was the school. And so now it'll be funny to see it and be like, oh yeah, that's the apartment that I pay for and the apartment that I actually live in full time.
How are you feeling about your future right now? Are you worried that this situation might stretch out? Are you more hopeful?
I would definitely say I'm more hopeful now than probably when this all first started. I feel like even if this pandemic stretches out, as long as I have my job or hopefully my full-time job too, I am not too worried about losing my new housing situation because I know that I'll have a job that will pay me.
Jamie Waldron, thank you so much for joining us and congratulations on graduating.
No problem. Thank you so much.
The coronavirus pandemic has left little room for us to take note of the things we commemorate and remember. Last month marked the 50th anniversary of the release of the very last Beatles album, Let It Be. For millions of listeners, this album was the end of one of the most transformative periods in music. But as NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker learned, it has particular resonance for photographer Ethan Russell.
It was on his second assignment that American photographer Ethan Russell found himself watching John Lennon listen to the White Album for the very first time. The 22-year-old had arrived in London just a few months before. The plan was to be a writer, but he had brought a camera with him. Russell was untrained, but a fledgling Rolling Stone magazine from his hometown in San Francisco needed some photographs. His first assignment, Mick Jagger. The second, John Lennon.
I was really nervous for that one, you know, because it was a Beatle, because it was John Lennon. But then once the camera goes up in front of my eye, the nerves go away.
Lennon liked the image Russell captured that day, so much so that later he invited him to photograph him and Yoko Ono in the hospital shortly after Ono had miscarried.
I think the secret was they could see themselves in my photographs. And I think that it was easier for them to recognize themselves in the picture, recognize what they were doing. Here I am, you know, they're musicians. They're making music. And when you see them through my lens, it looks like that because I don't change stuff.
While luck may have played a role in how the untrained photographer got his start, Russell's ability took control from there. He would go on to capture some of the most iconic moments in music during the end of one of the 20th century's most influential periods.
It was very much the John Lennon life is what happens while you're making other plans. I didn't think about being a photographer. I just did what was in front of me.
In 1968, he was hired by the Rolling Stones to photograph their rock and roll circus tour. The year after, the cover for their album Through the Past Darkly, and later, their Let It Bleed tour, which ended infamously in Altamont, California. Woven in would be stints with the Beatles, the band's last public performance, the band's last album cover, followed by the band's very last photograph together as a group.
That was supposed to be a studio shoot for which I was preparing the whole week, right? And then the night before I got, oh no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go down to John's house. But they were kind of miserable. If I shot 8 rolls, if that, 6 rolls, I don't think George looked happy in one photograph.
Did you have a sense that you were capturing all these last moments? The last performance, the last photo shoot, the last album cover?
No. There's something about the Beatles breaking up which was fundamentally unthinkable, you know, because of who they were.
After the Beatles, Russell began working with The Who. A chance drive with the band outside of London, past some strange objects, and Russell asking Pete Townsend to pull over, resulted in one of rock's most famous album covers.
I notice out of the corner of my eye these shapes. I have no idea what it is. We go up to it, I have no idea what it is. And then I look up and Pete's pissing on it. And I thought, that's good. And so I didn't shoot a lot of it because I thought it was too outrageous. And then, you know, we get in the car shortly thereafter and going down. And then, you know, 10 minutes down the road, I think, I hope I got it, you know?
He had gotten it. And the cover of Who's Next was done. After came the photos for the book that accompanied their next album, Quadrophenia. This work earned Russell a Grammy nomination. For the first time, Russell has collected his photographic work into a single retrospective. The book is, in Russell's words, a collection of the pictures he likes. Among his favorites, that very first photo of John Lennon. Why do you think that photograph has had such resonance for you?
Intimacy. It's much more about feeling, right? Which is what you're sort of going for, you know? I mean, to extend it a little bit, you're going for composition, you're going for the moment, you're going for certain elements, but ultimately, to me, it's about communicating feeling, and specifically about communicating feeling about the individual in front of the camera. I want to be able to feel the person. You can really feel them, can't you?
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.